Hey, tonight's topic is an introduction to Basil Bakalov, as was mentioned. And I'll just start off with a following thought. And that is, you may know that the classic requirement to earn smicha was a person was tested on the halacha as a Basil Bakalov and Tarbuvus. And Rabbi Heinemann explained that the reason for that is as follows. If you want to know many other halachas, I'll pick an example. If you want to know what bracha do you recite before you eat a banana? Well, there's a machlokes about what the right bracha is, and you open up the Shulchan Aruch to the right page, and you could find out what the answer is, and you'll know this is the bracha you recite when you eat a banana. But what happens if I stick a milchuk knife into a potato that's cooking in a fleishig oven? What do I do now? Where do I find that halacha? There is no page where it has halachas of potatoes in the fleishig oven. So a person needs to put together a lot of pieces of information in order to come to the right answer to that. That shows a certain amount of skill and intellect in order to be able to answer those questions. And that's what the test was to see if the person deserved to be a rabbi. So as you start off in learning halachas of Basil Bakalov, you're going to be learning all different types of concepts. And they all come together when questions come up and when you have to understand how to deal with an issue. They're not as straightforward. It's not this, yes, this, no. There's a lot of pieces that have to come together. And my job tonight is to try to introduce those ideas to you. I'm not here to tell you the answers. I'm here just to give you an idea of questions that come up, introduce you to some concepts, and leave you open to that when you actually learn through these halachas, when you start get into more depth about what they're about, you yourself will know better and be able to know how to answer these questions or deal with other issues that come up. So I'm going to talk about five different groups of items, three at least, and if we have time, I'll do the other two as well. Excuse me, and the first is about separating. And that is, of course, we all know a person, you cannot eat milk and meat together. And in fact, you have to wait, if you eat meat, you need to wait 6 hours before you eat milk. Now, when you learn more about this, you're going to find out the Gemara does not say you have to wait 6 hours. That's not what the Gemara says. The Gemara says you can't eat dairy until the next meal. What does that mean? You have to wait till the next meal. Some people say you have to wait 6 hours because that's give or take the amount of time between one meal and the next. Other people say, no, you just have to finish the meal. Just bench. If you finish the meal, once you finish the meal, we'll go to the next meal. We can eat dairy afterwards. Okay. Well, what's the halacha about that case? How much of what we do is actually required by halacha? How much is a minhag and how much is a chumrah? Why does that make a difference? It makes a big difference because what happens if you have a child who very much needs to eat dairy right after he ate meat, or someone who's ill who needs to eat dairy after he ate milk? Well, I'm sorry, after he ate meat. Then understanding how important it is that we actually wait 6 hours plays a big role in that kind of a question. So as you learn the dinim, you'll find out exactly why do we wait 6 hours and which way do we hold and how much are we just actually required and how much are we just being machmir on choosing that din, and then be able to answer those kind of questions. Now, if I ate a part of a food that was made in a fleishig pot, okay, I cooked up some spaghetti in a fleishig pot, I don't have to wait 6 hours. That doesn't make me fleishig, so does what we quote, make me fleishig, I don't become fleishig, I don't have to wait 6 hours. Okay, that's fine if I just cooked up spaghetti in the pot. But what happens in some other cases? What happens if I made a challah and the challah was fleishig, there was meat in the challah, but I just ate a potato from the challah. I didn't eat any of the meat that's in there. Well, what happens similar, a little different? I went to a restaurant where and I got French fries. And the restaurant uses that same fryer to make meat and chicken in it as well. Do I have to wait 6 hours again? Yes. Okay. What happens if instead of eating just the potato or the French fries, I cut an onion with a dairy knife? I'm sorry, I cut an onion with a meat knife. Do I have to wait 6 hours now? Well, in all those cases, what the person did was he ate something that was inherently parv. He ate something that didn't have meat or milk in it at all, but it had some kind of a contact with meat, some kind of a connection to what happened with the meat. So does he have to wait 6 hours? You don't have to wait 6 hours. I could tell you the answer to those questions, but you'll be better off learning it yourself. And you'll know yourself now, when do I have to wait 6 hours and in which of those cases do I not have to wait 6 hours? Now, everything I told you till now was about waiting after you eat meat before you eat after you eat meat before you eat milk. What about the other way around? What happens if I ate milk? What do I have to do now if I want to eat meat afterwards? So you don't have to wait 6 hours. But there are some other requirements. And those the basis of those requirements is I need to eat something parv, I need to drink something that's parv, and then wash or check my hands to make sure there's nothing dairy left on them. Okay, but there's an exception to that rule. And that is, if I eat something called hard cheese, then I have to wait 6 hours before I eat meat. Okay, well, what's that? What's hard cheese? I mean, is mozzarella cheese, is that hard? No, that doesn't sound like that. We know that that's not. Well, what is hard cheese? Well, that's a question. You have to figure out what is hard cheese that I have to now wait 6 hours after it. What, one common example that is considered hard is Parmesan cheese. Okay, so if I take a bite of Parmesan cheese, I can't eat meat for 6 hours. Okay, but what happens if I didn't? I didn't eat Parmesan cheese by itself. I made eggplant Parmesan. So I melted the Parmesan cheese into my food. Or what happens if I didn't melt it, but I sprinkled, I made a Caesar salad and it has Parmesan cheese mixed into it. Do I have to wait 6 hours for that also? I saw it myself. I walked into a pizza shop and they had little shakers on every table of Parmesan cheese. So that means if the people shake a little Parmesan onto their pizza, do they have to wait 6 hours now before they eat meat? There are different opinions about those questions. Something that applies to people, you know, somewhat, I don't know, all the time, but it comes up here and there for people. Okay, there's another group of halachas that comes up. People may not be as familiar with that. It has to do also with separating between milk and meat. And that is that if there are two people who are good friends or close relatives, then they can't eat on the same table, one eating meat and one eating milk. And the reason is because people who, you know, friends or get along with each other very well are likely to eat something from the other person's plate. So if I'm eating meat and you're eating milk, then I might reach over and take something out of your plate and eat something that I wasn't supposed to be eating. So the Chazal said a person should not eat, two people shouldn't be eating together one meat and one milk if they're friends or really close with each other, unless there's some kind of a mark or some kind of a hecker on the table to remind them not to share food. So whereas you could eat in a, I don't know, with someone who you don't know at all, that would be fine. You could actually even eat with someone who's eating not kosher. But if you're eating milk that's kosher and they're eating flesh that's kosher, it's someone who you're friends with, then you would not be allowed to do that. And one last thing about separating has to do with like this. There's an isser to make bread that's either milchigs or fleishigs. And the reason for that is because bread is usually parv. People expect bread to be parv. So if bread would be, let's say, milchigs, someone might put, make a meat sandwich out of it. Well, the other way around, if it was fleishigs, somebody might put some cream cheese onto it. So Chazal said, not only can't you eat it with the other type, you can't eat them, you know, the milchig bread with fleishigs, you can't even eat it at all. It's totally not kosher. You're not allowed to have it at all. Okay, that's the basic halacha. You're not allowed to make bread that's milchigs or bread that's fleishigs. Okay, but what happens if it's not exactly bread? What happens if it's cake or croissants or danishes? Those allowed to be milchigs or fleishigs? How about corn dogs? That's what corn dogs are. They're sort of bread with a hot dog inside of it. How about bread that's DE? It's made on dairy equipment. Is that okay? Mir Tashem, as you learn through the course, I believe I actually saw some of these questions in your outline of what's going to be covered. These are all types of things that you will learn about. In Mir Tashem, you're going to be learning about this whole topic of separating between milk and meat. It's not just that we don't eat milk and meat together, but it comes with many details that go along with that. And as I mentioned in the past couple of minutes, okay, have any questions before I move on to the next point?
We had one question that came up in the chat. Does hard cheese also apply to Sephardim?
Okay, it's a good question. I'm stumped. I'm Ashkenazi. I would go look it up. I don't know. I don't remember offhand. I tell you to ask a rabbi. You could call me back tomorrow and I can go look it up. I don't remember offhand. Definitely for Ashkenazim, that's where I am. That's how I think of life, but I don't remember offhand. Sorry about that. Okay, any other questions? Okay, I'll keep on moving. Okay, I'm going to mention now a whole group of scenarios of things that questions that come up about milk and meat together. In all these questions, I'm not going to give answers. Okay, I'm just going to mention questions, and the idea is just to realize the broadness of what you will be covering when you learn Basa B'chol. Let's go to the beginnings. I found the milchig fork in the fleshig dishwasher. Okay, can I use that fork? Do I have to kasher it? Well, and what about the rest of the dishwasher? The fleshig stuff that was in the dishwasher. What do I do with all that stuff? Okay, what happened? I found this dish in the wrong side. That's one type of question. Well, okay, how about like this? Can I eat a corned beef sandwich on a milchig table? Is it worse if it would be a hot pizza on a fleshig table? Is that worse? Was that okay or is that not okay? Can I use the same oven or the sink or stovetop or a microwave for milchigs and for fleshigs? Okay, if you tell me I can't do that, well, what do I do if I only have one oven in my house? There's only one stovetop. What do I do now? If you tell me I can't eat them, I can't use the same one for milchigs and fleshigs, what do I do now? What am I supposed to do if I only have one of them? How about if I bake challah in my fleshig oven? Is it okay to put cream cheese onto that? What about the other way around? What about if I have crackers that are, say, that they're DE? Can I eat those with meat? And last is, I cut something with a fleshig knife. I cut an onion with a fleshig knife. Can I put that into a pot of soup that I make in a dairy pot? Or how about can I put it into an omelet with cheese? Okay, so I just gave you this is, I don't know, 5-10 scenarios of issues that come up, Basar B'chol type questions that come up. And those are all questions you're going to learn about. And in my next section, we're going to talk about 6 different concepts that have to do with Basar B'chol. And the truth is that those concepts will answer the questions that I just gave you. I'm going to give you just an overview, just an introduction to those concepts. But those concepts that are going to be there are the clues or the tools to which you can answer those questions that I had. Okay. Any questions on that? Okay. Everyone's being really quiet. Okay. I'll keep on going. Okay. So I'm going to mention these 6 concepts. Some of them you'll be familiar with. Some of them are probably will be brand new to some of you. To most of you, again, and each one of them, I'm just going to give you just some basics and leave you for the actual learning to know more about it. Okay, so we all know you can't eat milk and meat. You can't put butter onto your turkey. Okay, butter is milchigs, turkey is fleshigs. You can't do those together. No problem. Okay, but there's a rule that's called tam ki'ikar. Tam ki'ikar means is tam means taste is ki'ikar. It's as if the food itself. That means that the taste of a food has the same status as the food itself. Just like I can't put butter onto my turkey, I also can't cook my turkey in a milchig pot. If I use the pot to cook up hot milk in it, and I clean out all the milk out of the pot, that pot, we say the pot is now milchigs, meaning it has tam of milk inside, absorbed into the pot, and I can't put my meat product into that pot. If I did do that, then the milk and the meat would mix together and it would make them treif. It would make them treif, it would make the pot treif, everybody would be treif over here. Okay, and that's why we all have in our homes, we have separate milk and fleshig dishes. Because the reason is that is because of this rule called tam ki'ikar. The taste of the food that I cooked in there, the milk that I cooked in there leaves a taste inside the pot. And therefore, even though there's none of the milk is left, the tam of that milk can come into the next food. Now, tam ki'ikar isn't just inside of a pot or a piece of silverware. It also applies to the foods themselves also, which means is that if I have a plate and on that plate I have a piece of meat and some rice next to it and the meat touches the rice is now fleshigs. That rice cannot be eaten with milk. Whether I have to wait 6 hours, that's not for now. But that the tam of the meat spreads into the rice also, even not just through a pot, even the meat itself, it could spread into the rice and now the rice is now fleshigs. Okay, that was my first. Please interrupt me if you want to. Okay.
Can you explain that rice again?
Sure. You know,
with the rice.
Sure. Yeah. I had on a plate a piece of meat and rice that was right alongside it. So if the meat touches the rice is now fleshigs. That means that I can't eat that rice with cheese because the tam of the meat, the taste from the meat spreads into the rice, and therefore the rice is considered fleshigs. But again, I'm not talking about whether you have to wait 6 hours or not, but the tam of that meat spreads into the rice And that has the status as if the rice is now meat, fleishigs, and I cannot put cheese onto it. Okay, that's called tam ke'ikr. The tam, the taste of something is ke'ikr. It's like the food itself. It's as if there's meat mixed into that rice. Was that clear enough?
Thank you. Thank you.
Sure, no problem. Okay, number two. As a rule, tam transfers when there's heat. Heat in this context means over 120 degrees. We call it Yad Saleh display. And for this context, that means it's over 120 degrees. Now, there is a way for tam to transfer without heat. It's called kavash, by, I think, soaking in a container for a long time. But put that on the side. As a rule, tam only transfers when there's heat, when it's over 120 degrees. Now, there's a subtlety to that din, which is it doesn't only depend on whether it's hot or not hot. What it also is that the primary way that tam transfers is only in a kli rishon. Kli rishon means is the primary pot, the pot that the cooking happened on, or the food was heated up on. So if I heat up something on the stovetop, that pot is now the kli rishon. Even if I take it off the fire, it stays the kli. It's the pot in which the original cooking was done. You may be familiar with that term from Shabbos. That's when the real amount of tam transfers. What happens if it gets out of that pot and moves into a second pot, what we call a klisheni? Let's say you take soup from the bowl, from the soup pot, and you put it into your bowl. So the bowl is a klisheni. Well, in a klisheni, tam doesn't transfer the same way. I didn't say it doesn't transfer. It doesn't transfer the same way as in a kli rishon. Exactly how much does or doesn't transfer is very fine details. You'll have to wait till you learn about that. But the primary way that tam transfers is only in a kli rishon, only in the main, the place where the food was heated or cooked in. That's where tam transfers. Once you leave the kli rishon, life becomes simpler. Things are not as complicated, not as easy for tam to transfer as they would be in the kli rishon. Okay, number three. So far, these last two I talked to you about was tam, taste transferring, because there's some kind of a contact between the food and a utensil or something like that. But the truth is, tam can also transfer through vapor also. It's called zeya. Okay? The Shulchan Aruch, one of the cases the Shulchan Aruch gives up for that is that if a person is drying his salami on top of a stovetop, then and on that stovetop he's cooking milk, so the vapors from that milk rise up and hit the salami. The salami is now treif. Okay? The milk from the salami never touched the salami. They're a foot apart from each other, but the vapor is going up from that salami that hit from the milk that hit the salami, make the salami treif. It's now milk and meat mixed together. Now, I suspect most people who run a kosher home would never think of putting a salami on top of a pot of milk. Most people wouldn't do that. But this halacha does come up when, let's say, a person wants to spice a chont. The chont's ready on the fire and it's cooking away, and I use the spices right above it. Well, the fleishig Zaya, the vapors coming up from that fleishig pot are going to hit my spices. Or what happens? I'm making a milchig soup and I'm pouring some oil into the soup. But when I pour the oil, if I pour the oil from a container, vapors come up from that milchig soup can make the rest of the oil in the bottle to be milchigs. When that happens, when it doesn't, like you guessed, you're going to learn about that. But that's a way for tam transferring, even though the thing's never touched. There was no direct contact between the tam and a pot or the tam and one food and the next food. Even so, tam can transfer through the vapors also. Okay. Now, so far I told you, I don't know, you call them three chumras, three strict things, the way tams transfer that make things trade. Now for some good news, or some coolers, okay? Two coolers coming out, number four and five. Number four is like this. Tom can transfer if you have two foods touch each other, foods in a pot, even vapors coming out of a food can transfer Tom from one place to the other place. But there's a rule, I'll say it in Hebrew first, Ein ha-balua yotze mekli lekli b'loi reitiv. Okay? All that means is that if you have Tom only absorbed into a food, it's not the actual meat itself. Let's say we have a fleishig pot. Then the tam cannot transfer from, it's only absorbed into the pot. The pot is not actually a piece of meat. It doesn't transfer to something else unless there's some liquid between them. Okay, I'll say that again. I have a pot that was fleishig. I cooked some meat in this pot. I cooked chicken soup in this pot. Okay, the pot is now fleishig. I clean it out, so there's no meat here. There's just a pot that has absorbed tam of fleishigs in it. If that pot touches a milk, let's say a milk, it's hot and it touches the milchik spoon, the blua, the absorbed tam, does not transfer into another kli unless there's some liquid in between them to help the transit go on. Okay, this was relevant to the questions about stovetops. When you get to that detail, that whether you can use your stovetop or not, is there liquid or is there not liquid in between it? I'm just giving you just the basics on that, on that one. This rule that tam can't it can transfer if food touches pots and even from pot to pot if there's a liquid, but if there's no liquid in between, tam won't transfer. Okay, my fifth rule, fifth concept, and that is like this: another kula, and this one also you may not have heard of, and that's a rule. It's a special rule that's just for basar b'chalav, just for basically it's just for milk and meat. And that is, it's called not bar not. Okay, what does that mean? The real term means noisen tam bar noisen tam, which means that if we have tam that transfers a kosher tam, I mean, let's say kosher meat, it transfers enough times, it gets weakened to the point that it doesn't, it can't become basar b'chalav anymore. It can't become milk and meat anymore. Okay, let me give you the Gemara's example, help you understand what I'm saying. The Gemara's example is, if I have a plate that was used for hot meat. Well, it's a fleshy plate now. Now I put a piece of hot fish onto that plate. So the tam from the meat went into the plate. Good. Now from the plate into the fish. Okay, well, the Gemara says is you could put cheese onto that fish. That fish, the tam transferred so many times, it transferred once into the plate and then from the plate into the fish, that it, you transferred so many times that you're okay and you could use that plate. You could use that fish with cheese. It had transferred so many times that makes it okay. Now, there's a lot of detail. I just gave you the very basics about that. And as I would tell people, is like, do not try this at home. Okay. Until you learned all the dinim, don't go ahead and say, hey, David said that you could do all these things. No. You have to know more what you're talking about. And maybe it's only the evid, etc. But there's such a concept and it's very specific. It's only for kosher. What I mean is, if I put something treif onto my plate, it keeps on transferring on a dozen times. It makes no difference. But when it's a kosher item, let's say it's fleishigs, and it has to then milk mix with milk to become treif, then we have this rule of not bar not. Okay, so that's another rule which plays a role in these kind of things, which is that when we're dealing with treif, tam can transfer many times and still be a problem. But when we're dealing with milk or meat, just milchigs or fleishigs, then at a certain point, the milk or the meat, so to speak, expires. It's just weakened. It's such a point that it can't make something treif anymore. Any questions so far? I have one more to go on here. Okay. Last but not least.
I have one question.
Go ahead.
When it comes to not bar not, is it going to be a set amount of times? Like it's going to be like once it traveled this many times, it's no longer a problem? Or is it going to be the type of things? Like if it went from like a kli rishon to a kli, like what's going to, so what's going to be the
I'll give you a little detail. You're really going to have to wait till you learn it, but I'll give you a little detail. And that is, it's called not bar not because it transferred two times. It was noisen tam. Bar means like the son of a noisen tam. So it transferred once from the meat into the plate. That's one knot. We say it was one knot, one nisinus tam. And then it transferred from the meat into the fish. That's two knots. At that point, the fish doesn't have the status of being fleishig anymore. It's fleishig, but you can add cheese to it at this point. Right? The more so you can eat it with cheese. So that's two knots, and one knot is into a plate and into a kli, and one is into a food. That's another condition as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The two knots are like that, has how they break up like that. Okay. But there's plenty more details. You just heard just a drop of not. I just want to introduce you. You said, here's such an idea. Most people who haven't learned basar b'chalav have never heard of this rule called not bar not. It's again, and it's special for kosher. But I mean, it doesn't work if something is treif. It's only from kosher that has to become treif, not something that starts off treif. Okay. And our last thing is the things that I told you beforehand, especially the kulas, the lenient parts of that I told you, those things are all very different when we deal with the food that's charif, that's sharp or sour, has a very strong taste to it. For those, a lot of the kulas all of a sudden fall by the wayside. I told you not bar not, those rules change if it's a davar charif. A klisheni, Tom doesn't transfer so well. No, not the same if it's a davar charif. So a lot of things change if it's a davar charif. What's an example of a charif? Onion, garlic, lemons, whiskey. Those are all things that have a sharp or a very strong or sour taste to them. And they're charif. And as soon as those things come into the picture, everything gets changed. So if I find out that what I did in my fleishigs or milchigs was I had cut lemons or I fried onions, all of a sudden the question becomes very different and adds a whole new dimension to a lot of the things that might have been okay if it was just potatoes are different all of a sudden when it was garlic instead of being potatoes. Okay, I'm going to move on to my next, but please ask me questions if you have at this point before I move on to my next section. Okay.
I have a question.
Go.
I posted, I don't know if anyone saw it, but I know that in many cases it can make a difference if something's been used within 24 hours. Mm-hmm. So is that like a case-by-case thing or is there a general rule that we can be aware of?
I'm about to talk about that.
Perfect.
You must Thank see you. What's on my paper coming next. Okay, it's coming next. Okay, so the concepts I told you until now, those are general concepts for that are special, particular have to do with Basa B'Challah, and that are some of them are even special Basa B'Challah. So now I'm going to mention two concepts that are only for cases of B'Dievet. Only if something happened by mistake, then these are going to apply. These are not concepts that we ever do as a choice, L'Chadchila. I mentioned you before about not Barnat. Certain things of not Barnat are Mutter, even L'Chadchila, you can do them. Not all, but some things are Mutter, even L'Chadchila. But the two things I'm going to mention now are only B'Dievet, okay? And the first one is something called Bittul B'Shishim. That is, if there's very little milchigs, fleishigs, or for that matter, treif either, and it's so little that there's 60 times as much kosher as there is non-kosher, or there's 60 times as much parv as there is fleishigs, then it's Bittul, it's nullified, it doesn't count, and the whole mixture is permitted, okay? I remember once we had a situation, it's actually a neighbor who came over and said they were making chicken soup, and this neighbor also made their own gefilte fish. They round make the gefilte fish into little balls, and then they would cook them. And instead of putting the fish into the fish pot, she put them into her soup pot, okay, into her chicken soup. Okay, so here she had fish cooking with her milk, with her meat. That not what we're doing now, but you know, I have milk, fish, and meat together either. And the question was, is it butter or was it not butter? If there would be little enough, it wouldn't make a difference. A drop of milk spritzes into your challah. If there's so little in it, you're not allowed to put it in on purpose. But if it happened, it could be mutter because it's batel b'shishim. There's so little that it doesn't count anymore and it doesn't give any taste and it doesn't count. Okay, that's one rule called bittul b'shishim. Okay, there's another rule, and that's called what the person mentioned who asked beforehand, which was eina ben yomer. And that is when we eina ben yomer literally means is not from today. Not from this day. And it means is that if we have some tam, treif or fleishigs or milchigs, any tam that was absorbed into a pot or to a dish, and it sat there for 24 hours, after 24 hours have passed, it's not from this day, it's from a different day, that's what we say, it's ain't a binyama, it's from 20 more than 24 hours ago, it can't have any effect b'dievet on the food that's cooked in there. So if I had a fleishig pot and I cooked milchigs inside of that pot, but that the last time I cooked fleishigs was more than 24 hours ago, then the food that I cooked in it does not get affected. Now the pot would get messed up because the pot just got milk absorbed into it. It's a fleishig pot, but the milk that I cooked in there does not get affected by the oven. The food would be okay. So when I talked about bittul b'shishim, you're not going to have bittul b'shishim from the walls of a pot. Bittul b'shishim is more like a little bit of food falls in or a knife is in the wrong place. So a knife has very little metal to it. You know, how much blia could there be in there? But ein ben yomer is very much could be relevant. And in fact, when you ask a question, something went wrong in my kitchen. I did the wrong thing with this or that. The other thing, one of the questions that the rabbi always wants to know is, when was the last time you used that pot? Okay, if the fleishig pot was last used 2 days ago, then you're okay. The food won't be affected. The pot might be, but the food wouldn't be as effective. Okay. So now, even though I just told you that there's this big leniency called Eina ben yomer, we have to bear in mind that that has its own rules to it also. Like, for example, I mentioned before about Dava Charif. Well, Dava Charif turns Eina ben yomer back into as if it is a fresh pot. It's not Eina ben yomer. If you cook something charif in it, so I mentioned before, you fry onions in a pot, in a pan, even if that pan hadn't been used for 24 hours, it might not help it. It might be too bad on you. So, excuse me. So you'd have to know, you have to say, it's ain't ben yomer, but it was davar charif. I'm just saying is that these are, I'm mentioning you ideas, But there are lots of details, as I mentioned. There's another thing about Bittul B'Shishah. There's something that I'm not going to talk about. It's called Chanan. Stands for Chatich Anasas Nevela. Okay? That affects the way you calculate whether something is Bittul B'Shishah or not. So I'm just throwing it out to you that there's an idea of Eina Ben Yoma. I'm not sure how much the course is going to cover that. But it's a concept that you should be aware of, which comes into play in many situations. But as with everything else, it has its own quirks and details that affect what the halacha is. Okay, before I go to my last section, any questions?
Yeah, there's one question that was posted in the chat.
Yeah.
Do these rules apply to cast iron, which is meant to build up the flavor based on what's burned into it?
Okay, it's a really good question because cast iron pots, pans are like, they'll tell you not to wash it with soap even. You want to get the taste that's in there. So it depends like this. If the pan or the pot is actually cleaned out, wiped clean, there's nothing left on it, and all we're talking about is absorbed taste, we'll follow the din. The din says that if it's Eina Ben Yoma, it doesn't affect it. We wouldn't be worried about it. But that's only true if you actually clean it out, that it, literally it's clean, like you touch it and you don't feel any grease or anything like that. If you really did a job to get it clean, which I don't think is the typical in a cast iron pot. If you left some grease on the outside of the pot, then in fact you would have a concern, even if it was Eina Ben Yoma. You wouldn't be able to say it was 24 hours because that stuff that's on there, it doesn't only Eina Ben Yoma only works for what's absorbed into the pot. Doesn't help for the what's on the surface of the pot. So if there was actually something left on the surface, then Eina Ben Yoma wouldn't help you. Okay. Anything else? Okay. I'm going to go to my last section, small section over here. And that is, there are other halachas that are special to basar b'chalav. And that is, we all know we can't eat milk and meat together. And I just talked to you for the past half hour about all kinds of details about eating milk and meat together. There's also two other halachas that apply to basar b'chalav, and that is, we're not allowed to cook them together, and we're not allowed to have any benefit, any hanah from basar b'chalav. So, cooking together would be relevant. If a person worked as a chef in a non-kosher restaurant, they would have a question of it's forbidden to cook them. Even if you're not going to eat them, it's usher to cook basar b'chalav, to cook milk and meat together. And the hana is a much more common question that people have, or much issue that people have, is that you want a pet food, or pet foods that have in them milk and meat together, and potentially has an isser of hana. The pet is allowed to eat non-kosher. He's allowed to eat basar b'chalav also, for that matter. But I can't feed my pet basar b'chalav, because then I'm having benefit from it. My pet needs to eat, and I'm feeding him basar b'chalav. That I'm not allowed to do that because I'm having hanah from the basar b'chalav. So within these rules of hanah and bishul, the isur to cook and the isur to have hanah, here there are some details. The first is, it only applies if the meat portion is either beef or lamb or goat. I mean, it has to come from a cow, a sheep, or a goat. They don't have to have been shechted, but it only applies to those animals. It doesn't apply to poultry, like chicken or turkey, and doesn't apply to non-kosher species, like pork. It only applies if it's beef or lamb or goat. That's the meat portion of it. Second is, it includes, most dairy products are included in this rule. So whey or milk powder or casein, those are all considered milk for these purposes. But there's this particular leniency, and that is lactose, which is the sugar that comes from milk. Lactose is not included in these dinim. The reason it has to do with, because lactose is only milk and rabbanon. So lactose, if there's lactose in your pet food, that does not cause an issue of basar b'chalav. It would have to be something, so to speak, more dairy, like whey or milk or casein. And the last thing is that these rules that you're not allowed to cook basar b'chalav and you're not allowed to have benefit from it is only if the milk and the meat were cooked together. If they were just mixed together, that would not be a problem. Okay, you could have enough from it if there was such a thing. You could have enough from it, like you feed it to your pets, and you'd be allowed, well, you wouldn't be allowed to cook it because then you'd be cooking them together. But as far as feeding it to your pet, if it was just mixed together, that would be okay. The isser is only if the basar and the chalav are actually cooked together. So those are special halachas for basar b'chalav, the isser hanav, the isser to have benefit from it and to cook from it. Okay, so I'm done. Hopefully I whet your appetites enough that you'll want to go continue on the course and actually learn the halachas and see for real. Let me know if you have any questions. I'm still here. Well, we have time still. If there are any more questions, but I'm finished with what I wanted to say.
There's one more question that was written in the chat. Could you please define mamashas in regards to the transfer of Tom?
Okay, so I could try. We actually had a question about that. It actually had to do with cast iron pots, and we brought it to Rabbi Schwartz. Rabbi Schwartz, who was when he was alive, was the Abbezin here in the CRC. And he said like this. He said, run your hand along the pot. Okay, just, you know, rub your hand on the pot. If you feel something, that's mamasha. That there's some residue left behind. If you don't feel anything left behind, then whatever is there is considered to be absorbed. So it's a matter of, you know, touching it and putting your hands across it. And what do you feel something or do you not feel something? I don't have any cast iron pots in my house. But my regular pot, if you walk into the kitchen, you touch the pot, you feel nothing because it's been clean and you just feel the metal. If you do feel something else, some grease or some residue, then that's considered that there's something left behind. Okay, do we have anything else? Okay, so we get out early for class tonight. Oh, is there another question?
I just put in the chat. Okay. Once you go out, the origin and the different applications of Yekkies who only wait 3 hours or juice from the Netherlands who may only wait 1 hour. Like, do these also apply to things like hard cheese? And it looks like I got auto-corrected in the chat, so I apologize for words there. But
okay. So the answer is, when I started, I mentioned that the Gemara doesn't say you should wait 6 hours. The Gemara says, if you eat meat, eat milk at the next, don't eat milk to the next meal. There are many different interpretations of what that means. And again, most people who are Ashkenazi wait 6 hours. Some people don't, some people are a little different, but that every person should definitely follow their minhag of what their family custom is to how long they wait. You said maybe 3 hours or 1 hour, they should follow their family customs. But my point then was that even within the amount of time that you wait, you're going to have to find out, is that the din? Is that a requirement that I have to wait that amount of time? What is my requirement? And what is my being just, is our custom to do that thing? And that will make a difference when something is not so simple. Okay, we have someone who's ill and they need to take something dairy if they just ate meat, then those kind of questions come up. Otherwise, do what your minhag is, you should follow. But what happens when something, you have to do something different? That's when you have to know the details of the halacha in order to be able to answer that question.
Thank you.
Okay. Is that it?
Thank you so much, Rabbi Cohen. We really, really appreciate your time.